Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is an animator who is probably best known for his tenure at Bethesda, from Skyrim all the way up to Starfield, and he is the fellow bestie of Dennis Mahionis. I'd like to welcome Jeremy Bryant. How you doing, man?
Good. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, likewise. I thought a cool place to start, because we were talking a little bit about this off air, was your commute to Bethesda. And how you?
Yeah, I thought it was funny. You know, I watched your interview with Nate Perkypile, and he was talking about how far people had to drive to work. And I was like, well, I flew to work. So for almost 5 years, I flew just weekly. I'd fly one direction each week.
Yeah.
Work for like 10 days straight, and then take 4 days off. So yeah, for 5 years, I commuted by plane quite a while.
So how many hours is that, including, because you have to wait around, right? Like check-in time, and then. Waiting around.
Yeah, the flight's not too bad. It's usually, I think, around about 2 hours. But you've got the security and all that jazz on the front. You know, each time. And then DC, you're flying into DC too. So there's, you got all the DC traffic and whatnot. And there's a lot of people that commute there with the government. So, you know, at any given time, you know, my plane was full of like Congress people and staffers, you know, every flight. So it's busy.
What did management say about you doing that commute?
They were doing me a favor, right? So it wasn't, when I took the job, my intention was to move there. That was during like the 2008, 2009 crash.
Yeah.
The tail end of that, we tried to sell our house for like 2 years and we weren't able to. We had some kind of complicated family issues, and the kind of longer that I was there, the more I realized that the best place for my kids was probably where they already were. In terms of having family and whatnot here to kind of support us through that. And I just said, hey, I need to have a little bit of a flexible relationship with work. And like I said, I would do 10 days on, 4 days off. So it was full time. It was 40 hours a week, but it would be, you know, split a couple of days so I could fly less, because it was expensive.
Yeah, I bet.
But they were okay with that. I mean, it was a temporary thing. And it seemed to work really well for almost 5 years. It was almost to the end of Fallout 4 that I did that. And then I did eventually switch to being kind of more of a hybrid role, where I would spend 25% of the time in the office. So I'd go to the office for like a week a month, and then be remote for the rest of it.
Okay, so you made it
work. I did that for quite a while too. Yeah.
I suppose the good thing about plane is at least you're not flying the plane. Like with a car, you actually have to drive and focus on the road. So if you're driving 2 hours.
Yeah, you just kind of check out.
Yeah, you can just take a nap or something. Listen to some music, just chill. So,
but doing that for so long, I definitely like used up all my, you know, hey, will you take me to the airport coupons? Right? So it was we had a good system. I think I just booked I'm actually going out to DC in a couple of weeks. I booked an award flight with all my miles. I have over a million miles that I can spend.
Wow.
So got a lot of trips I can take.
Yeah. It's fun story, man. Fun story.
Yeah.
So people have an idea of the dedication you had.
But dude, I loved working there. I loved working at the studio, on the games, like all the people. And when you're living away from your family, you kind of form a different kind of a bond with the people that you're with.
Totally.
Because you're not with your spouse or your kids or whatever. And that's how Dennis and I got to be so close. Yeah.
Yeah, so how did it work in terms of the werewolf? Because he came to you
The werewolf, oh, you can retell
with
the
this
story.
idea. Yeah,
I know,
because
he kind of,
he
I
told
think it
part of
just
the
sort of
story.
happened. It just kind of happened. We, like, I know he, it was kind of like the Khajiit, the Argonians were, it looked like a guy in a costume. We knew it wasn't quite cool enough. I will say that's one of the really great things about working there too, is they were pretty flexible. Like if you wanted to work on some extra thing, like nobody really poo-pooed that at that time. Like you had a lot of freedom to kind of do extra stuff if you wanted to.
Ninja
That was
culture, yeah.
okay. Yeah. So we just, just kind of for fun, I think we picked it up and started like working on it. And then all of a sudden, like a month later, on our own time, it sort of was done, and it worked, and it looked, reasonably cool. I think we had gotten to a point where it would kind of need to be added to like a production schedule to like finish it. And I think we had heard talk that maybe the werewolf was not good enough, and they were talking about maybe either cutting it or redoing it. And we just kind of said, hey, we have this thing. Do you want to come look at it? And it went over pretty well. So,
But you did
yeah.
something with the camera, right? Because the werewolf was basically the loader was not able to keep up with the werewolf, and so you did
Oh,
something
when
with
it,
the
yeah, when
zoom.
it, well, yeah, that's just like a standard, like FOV, yeah, FOV, kind of a push where, yeah, you widen the FOV and you feel like you're going faster than you really are. All the driving games do it. They widen the FOV and it feels like things are going by you faster. Yeah,
Yeah,
because
because.
you could outrun the loader. Yeah, the same was true for, I think, for the horse. It was possible to outrun the loader at some point.
Because I would think that would be a programmer's job to deal with that, but I guess animators
Yeah, but
deal with that as well.
you can only like load in. Those games are huge. There's so much content. Like you're at the mercy of the hardware, right? So, and I will say, like if you made a thing, let's say we make this werewolf thing that like breaks the rest of the game, like you have to rewrite your loader. Like that thing is not going in. Like it would have no chance of surviving.
Right. So how did the tools become more robust as you moved through your career at Bethesda in terms of from an animation standpoint?
Animation-wise, we went through a couple pretty big iterations. When I first started there, they had just picked up. If you look at like the animation in Fallout 3, for instance, and granted, I think they had like three or four animators. It was like hard-coded like state machines. I think an engineer like plugged in, walk animation goes in like this slot,
Yeah.
type thing. So they had just licensed Havok Animation. Havok, the physics engine, they also made an animation tool. So it was like a middleware, and they had just integrated that. Havok Animation and Havok Behavior, which let you kind of how Unreal is now, like you could sort of visually, build the logic and connect all the states and sort of see what was happening and do some pretty creative things with that. So that was the kind of the first big iteration. And we, when I say we, the animators, we didn't really have tech art. At that time, it wasn't a thing that Bethesda had. So the animators did a lot of that. I mean, the engineering certainly helped, but a lot of that like logical creation was stuff that we did. That was a big change.
Does it remove some of the monotonous tasks of animation as well?
I don't know if it removes the monotonous task, but I think the biggest thing is it empowered the animator to sort of end-to-end put something in the game. Like you could make a thing, put it in the game, hook it up, see it, iterate on it really fast, and adjust it if you didn't like it. Like there was a lot of pretty cool stuff you could do. You could definitely, I think much to the ire of some of the engineers, like you could, an animator had the ability to sort of like hijack what an actor was doing, at least like
Right.
visually, right? So like they just didn't know what it was like, the engine tells it what to do, but then this middleware, you could sort of like, oh no, I'm gonna do this other thing. So you could create problems pretty easily. So we tried to be careful with that, but it was pretty cool to be able to put your own stuff in the game and have control of it.
Was mocap used on Skyrim?
We did, yeah. So they had when I first started there, they had what was it called? It was sort of a, I don't want to say janky, but it was kind of janky. It was called Phase Space. It was like a was one of those systems where you wore the suit that instead of having like regular traditional markers,
yeah,
it had like coded LEDs that were like powered. You had like a battery pack, and each one had a different like frequency, so the cameras could tell what marker it was. And you know, it got reasonably good data, but it was not the best, not super flexible. It sort of was what it was. Later, at the end of Skyrim, I sort of wound up owning my own motion capture system at one point, kind of by accident. I had a friend's studio that closed down, and I bought it from him. And so there was actually a point where I brought my own. I had a Vicon system that I brought in there and sort of demoed it to them for like maybe a year. And so I would say all the DLC for Skyrim was shot on that system. But prior to that, it would have been the Fate Space.
So then did Bethesda purchase your system, or did they get another system similar to the system
you were using? Yeah, they got their own one. That was sort of a favor. I just wanted to like let them try it and use it. There was a point where we talked about trying to do some kind of a purchase, but that's kind of a murky thing. I think at like the admin level to like be buying a expensive piece of equipment from an employee, right? So that never went anywhere. But I did get them in touch with the Vicon folks, who I already knew because I had worked with them before, and they bought at the time a pretty nice system.
How do you find animating hands? Because I've heard that they're one of the hardest things to animate.
You know, they're complicated, right? But in terms
yeah,
of I don't think,
yeah.
For me, I mean, I don't think they're the hardest thing to animate. But there's a lot of nuance. Yeah, a lot of nuance. We never capture any finger data. You can capture that stuff. You know, there's a lot of different ways to do it, but it's at least for what we do, it's not. I don't think it's all that necessary. Probably take a lot more time.
What would you say is the hardest thing to animate then?
The hardest thing to animate, like, I think when you could argue with hands. I know Mike talked about it in his interview, like contact surfaces.
Yeah.
Like when you're interacting with things, that's when I think it gets more complicated. If you've got like multiple actors, you're trying to like untangle like how they're attaching to each other, or like or wrestling or combat or whatever, that stuff is really complicated, especially on the mocap side. If you've the newer systems are better, but you know, the older ones, you'd have a lot of like marker mix up, things like that. So even if you had mocap, it'd be a lot of animation and cleanup to make that look good.
Word on the street is you're the gun guy, the gun reloader guy.
Who told you that? I did. Yeah, I worked on pretty much all the firearm stuff for Fallout is what I mostly worked on for that game. Yep.
So why are you so obsessed with it? What's the thing that you love?
I'm not obsessed with it. It was just I had worked on shooters before. I loved Fallout 3. It's one of my to this day one of my favorite games. But you couldn't really play it as a shooter. You had to use VATS really, I think, unless you had the combat shotgun and just like ran up to people's faces. It was right. So with Fallout 4, I think it was just an effort to try and make it certainly it's not Call of Duty, right? Like it's an RPG at the end of the day.
Yeah.
All kinds of numbers, and like there is so much stuff going on behind the scenes that design has done to manipulate kind of what those guns do. But to try and make it at least a viable shooter, I think was my goal. I think it was. I think largely. I mean, it definitely was better than Fallout 3.
Because what's the most important aspect then when you're doing the animation for the reloading of a gun? Or guns
the most
themselves.
Important, I mean, just to have it be cool is the right. So it's hard because a lot of those guns they're pretty nonsensical. There's some weird stuff, and it might not be built right. Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We were pretty limited with like the number of bones that we had. I think we had like 15 bones in a weapon that you could manipulate in any given way. And just to try and make them all feel different, and to have a and then to have them still be fun, you know, because you have this like wide dynamic range that, like I said, design can like turn all these dials, and you might animate something and make it like super cool and feel awesome, but then in the scale of like balance and like progression in the game, not everything can be as good. You have to make some things less good, you have to make right And so that was pretty difficult to get that right, the tuning right.
You did some of the non-combat animations as well?
So yeah, like similar to what I did on Skyrim. On Skyrim, I did like all the workbenches and crafting. Like if you see a guy like sharpening his sword on a wheel or chopping wood or whatever, I did most of that stuff. Pretty similarly for Fallout as well. Yeah, so all the crafting.
Is that just something you opted to do, or does someone tell you specifically to do that?
I think, I mean, I knew those are, those things are most likely to be mocap, right? So because of what they are, they're humans, right? So right away, okay, what's a human? You're doing kind of a natural thing. And I knew how to work the mocap pretty well. So that like kind of already puts you, you know, down that. And then the technical...
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Aspects of like hooking that stuff up, like the Havoc animation I talked about, I knew how to work all of that too pretty well. So you sort of know the pipeline. Like I was the guy that knew a lot of that pipeline pretty well, and then you just sort of naturally fall into it.
Yeah, but was mocap used for every animation? Because there would have been some stuff that you wouldn't be able to
for mocap. Like for a depend, you know, depend everyone know. Like there's a lot of hand key stuff too.
Yeah,
and like, depending on what.
Yeah, like you couldn't mocap Alduin the dragon, for example. Could you?
Oh no, all the creatures for the most part were probably hand keyed. Yeah, anything that would be humanoid, like I know that the trying to think of what we even call it. I mean, the giants, is it called a troll? I haven't played Skyrim in so long. Anything that had like two legs, right? Two legs and two arms was probably mocapped. Things that flew around, like we had all the dragon priests; those were all hand animated.
Yeah, the reason why I ask is I remember I watched some behind the scenes footage of the Hobbit films years ago.
Yeah,
and Smaug the dragon was mocapped with Benedict.
Oh Cumberbatch.
Yeah, so I was like,
I mean, you could again. It's like how much fidelity are you trying? You know, are you trying to get? And at the end of the day, you know, we were a pretty small team. We had we talked about this a little bit before. That was like a 100-person team. I think in animation we only had like 7 or 8 people that made that, right? So you have a finite amount of time to spend on any one thing. So if you want to do some like huge elaborate like mocap or whatever, a dragon or a horse, we did buy mocap for the horse. It would be a lot of setup and a lot of time to do it. And if that trade is worth it or not, you sort of have to decide.
Yeah, but I suppose back in the day, in the Skyrim days, there would have been some overlap in terms of people working on different stuff, right? Whereas imagine in Starfield, everything became more siloed and you couldn't have like a ninja culture where you could just...
Yeah, yeah. So, no, I kind of mentioned that where, yeah, in the early days, at least I, you know, again, my experiences are my own, but I always felt encouraged to sort of Wild West a little bit. Like, you know, as long as you got your regularly tasked work done, like it was okay if you like were doing extra stuff and had like a little bit of side action that you were excited about, just to keep it fresh because you're working on the same things day in and day out. So that was, yeah, that was very much encouraged. I think that's what you're referring to with the ninja culture thing. And that was awesome for Skyrim and for, to a large degree, for Fallout 4. It was that way too. Wasn't it until we started to grow, like a lot of the sort of management and production methodologies like that we had as a studio that, in my opinion, work really well. They don't scale, right? They don't scale well when you have a 200, 300, 400, you know, I don't even know what the actual dev size ended at with Starfield. I'm not sure. Somewhere between 400 or 500. And then you do sort of get, you know, you talk about like siloing. I mean, the thing to think about too is like we weren't all in the same building either. We had you know, for Skyrim and for, yeah. So for like Skyrim, we were all like, we all worked together. Like you knew everybody. And then largely for Fallout, it was largely the same. We did have some, a little bit of external work, but on Starfield, and I think Perky mentioned it on 76 too, you know, we absorbed an entire team from Bethesda Austin. You know, they had their own studio that was already there. It was Battlecry, I think, at the time. And so you're absorbing an entire team that has their own culture. They have their own game. So the siloing kind of geographically happens, but also just culturally it happens too. You get people who are not quite as tight-knit.
Well, I think if you have that amount of people trying to kind of migrate into that culture that fast, it's impossible for the culture to stay the same. Like, even if you think of terms of immigration, like if you have all these immigrants moving into a country, they don't have time to assimilate because they can just form their little group over here.
But I mean, we certainly needed, you know, that's kind of, it's like the catch 22 with just team sizes in general now is you want to do more, you want to reach further and make bigger, better games, so you need more people, right? So that's like you have to scale, but then the game also has to be that much more successful to pay for said people. You know, it just keeps, you know, you see that kind of at every studio. You see it, you know, Bungie, Ubisoft, like everywhere has the same kind of problems.
Well, it's not sustainable, and when you're that large, naturally bureaucracy happens. I don't see how you can make it work any other way, surely.
Yeah, no, it's definitely started to become different. You know, I still had a really good time on Starfield. I worked mostly with people that I already knew that were in Rockville, but we absorbed this entirely new studio, entirely, you know, they were made Bethesda Austin on 76 we did that. And then we had already had Montreal kind of helping. You know, they did some mobile stuff, but they were also helping with the games too. And then we had another developer that we sort of absorbed that was in Dallas. So it was a pretty rapid growth. But again, if you want to make, like, you know, Todd has the game that he has the vision for the game that he wants to make, and he knows he needs X number of people to do it. Like when you roadmap out what you're going to do, right? You can see if you need more devs, and it was obvious that we did. And so that is probably it's the only way really to grow that fast is to kind of wholesale absorb. You can't hire that fast, I don't think. It would be hard to hire onesies, twosies, and get up to the scale you needed.
Yeah, well, I'd imagine now the team size would stay relatively similar to what it was for Starfield going into Elder Scrolls 6. They wouldn't do another big jump, would they?
I wouldn't think so. Like it was funny. I had mentioned I had watched one of your interviews with Mike. Is it Mike York?
Yeah, Mike York. Yeah.
Yeah, he talked about his time at Rockstar. It was really interesting, and you know, they are such masters of, like, their games are so polished, and it's like you always wonder, like, how do they do it? Like, how you know, GTA 6, yeah, it's taken like 10 years. I get it, but I went and looked at the credits for Red Dead, and they had like 500 animators. It was like 85 just gameplay animators, and like another 80 cinematic ones, and another 100 face ones, and those team sizes are, it's bonkers. And then I think the overall dev size they said was around 1600, I think, on Red Dead 2.
Yeah, and they've only grown since then. Like, I know on Red Dead 2, Rockstar India had about 200 artists, animators, and then it grew to 1,000 for GTA 6. And I kind of get it, because
so they conceivably cheap labor. Almost 3,000 people maybe working on GTA 6, conceivably. I don't know.
Yeah, but then they're going to make that money back tenfold. I mean, GTA Online.
Yeah, but I just think about, like,
made like 8 billion or whatever it is.
In the it's not the investment, but just the context of having to grow a team, and then in siloing and management, and how do all those people communicate? He touched on that, like, how do all those people communicate and form any kind of a bond, like at work, when it's just like a random thousand people sitting shoulder to shoulder, like on an assembly line. I don't know. That doesn't sound all that.
No, it doesn't sound that great.
I'll be honest.
It sounds claustrophobic. It feels claustrophobic. Like
it sounds terrible. And we had a great studio, a great culture. Everyone was super talented and got along well. And even if you had people that you didn't get along with, like you found ways to work together and make cool stuff. So
how did the animation work in regards to procedural generated content? How does that work in conjunction with it?
In terms of procedural stuff, like animation, I can't say that we really had anything all that procedural. In terms of just like procedural content, I think we did, we used Houdini a bit on Starfield for like the landscape generation, I think, which is kind of a, procedural tool.
But would you use the procedural tool and then go in and just polish it? Or fix things up, maybe?
Animation-wise, like, not really. I mean, you might, like, run some, like, physics to get some, like, secondary motion on things, like, animation-wise. Certainly, you could have, like, simulated things, not really procedural, but you could have, like, simulated, cloth or whatever. But we didn't really have anything procedural in terms of animation that comes to mind, yeah.
Yeah, so what's your relationship with Todd been like from Skyrim days to Starfield?
Yeah, Todd, I think he's a good guy. When I interviewed there, he still interviewed everybody. Every hire was interviewed by him. So it was kind of neat getting, I knew who he was before I went there. I was, like I said, a Fallout 3 fan and Oblivion. And actually in college, I played Battlespire. I told him that and he apologized. He's like, I'm sorry. So sorry. But no, he's a cool guy. Right away you see it, like you can tell by watching interviews of him. He's got like plus 50 of confidence and charisma, right? So he definitely is a he's a neat guy to work for, I guess I would say. In terms of like creative direction, I was always surprised. And again, this is back on like Skyrim and Fallout. He would find time to like walk around. He would just like walk around everybody's desks and like chat and look at what they were working on. And even we had like a weekly animation meeting. I was always kind of surprised that often he would come to that. And even though he wasn't really like participating in it, he would come and just sort of observe and just kind of be part of the team. So I think in terms of having to like work for somebody, I had a pretty good relationship with him.
He wouldn't have been able to sustain that by Starfield, though, would he? I don't know how.
Yeah, I mean, even then, I mean, he was spread pretty thin. I think even once we kind of came out of Fallout 4, you could tell that it was like it's a lot for one person to have to do that stuff.
Oh, sure.
He has like his, he's got his the senior leadership, working for him, but it's. He still like wants to be involved. Like he's still the guy that has to make the calls on a lot of this stuff. So yeah, it's probably very stressful.
But he's not as hands-on. So there'd have to be levels of management. So it has to go through a person before it even gets to Todd.
I think like largely he still is making a lot of like the creative decisions. He's just not the one that has to like see it executed, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah.
So he can say, have an idea, I want this thing to be this way. And then, production will have to, allocate resources to do that. He plays the game a lot. He has a, which is good. I mean, he has a, I think a really good habit of playing the game and finding, what needs to change or what, he has good intuition for what'll make it fun.
Yeah, that's one of the common things I've heard from other devs is he's very in tune with knowing what the player will consider as fun, right? So
yeah,
he's more in tune with that than maybe some other people. But I just don't see how he's able to manage so many different things at the same time.
it's tough. I mean, and then like, I know, I think Dennis touched on that too, like with the Fallout show and, you know, he's involved in all these other projects like the Indiana Jones. I mean, I don't know what his schedule is like, but I, you know, I don't know. He seems to handle it okay. I mean, the times that I do see him on Starfield, I saw him less, mainly because at that point I had transitioned to a contractor. But it was funny. It was like right before COVID, you know, right before COVID, I transitioned to a contractor so I could continue working remotely. Right. So it was like, it was like getting to be a distraction. Like there were other people that wanted to work remote and it was like, right. So rather than to have to be like the only person in the org that was doing that and be like the example, I resigned and then came back as contractor. And then like a few months later, like COVID happened and everybody was working remotely anyway. So you know, in those kind of final stages of Starfield, you know, nobody was in the building, right? For at least the first part of that. And then certainly all of my travel stopped at that point too. So I probably went, I don't even know, 2 or 3 years without even seeing Todd towards the end, which was, you know, not great thing. Like you definitely, you know, want to.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
I have that time with people, but it is what it is.
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword, remote work. On the one hand, it probably increases productivity, particularly if you have to do a long commute because you don't no longer have to worry about the mental fatigue by the time sure. you get to the office. But then yep. you don't have the camaraderie and the ability to bounce ideas
there's
off
trade-offs.
Other people. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of trade-offs with it. I mean, you know, I've been doing it for like over a decade, right? So, and I can tell you, like, it's not for everybody. There are people who won't do well in that environment. There are people who will. You know, in my case, it was like the only way. The only way that I could work there was if I could still like see my kids and my kids and my family were like 1,000 miles away. So it was the only way that I could stay attached to the company is if I had something like that. You know, during COVID, I think, you know, they were. I'll say too, like I know one of the people you interviewed commented. I don't know if it was Perky about, you know, them delaying Starfield. And you have to think too, like they had to shift gears as a lot of developers did. A lot of companies did. Like one day, in the beginnings of COVID, there were like all of a sudden, we all have to work remote, and nobody has the infrastructure for it. We're not set up for it. You know, the CK doesn't work remotely, like our editor, right? So a lot of stuff needed to happen, and it takes time to sort of adapt into that kind of a workflow, right? It doesn't just happen overnight. So I think that costs some time.
Okay, so is that the main reason why Starfield was initially delayed?
I mean,
because of...
I don't know if it's the main reason, but I will say, like, there's lost time. There's lost time when you do that. When you switch over that, your model, your whole model of working together, right? All of a sudden, now we're not. It takes time to...
Yeah. But also the Microsoft acquisition, right? That would have changed things, I imagine, at least.
Yeah, I mean, that happened
level.
Too, but I don't know. I mean, again, by that point, I was already a contractor. It didn't seem really any different to me internally. I think they're very much, at least at that point, they were very much left alone. I don't think anything changed.
Yeah, because I'm wondering if being under the Microsoft umbrella, they would have access to more resources, maybe for QA,
maybe.
For example.
I mean, we had pretty good relationships with Microsoft before that. I mean, they'd have people that would help you, you know, figure out problems with a console or whatever. I think on might have been on Starfield, like, or no, it was on Skyrim. You know, you have to fit all that stuff like on a disk, right? And I if I remember correctly, I think we were one of the first games that had like some enhanced like disk capacity where you could, you know, they had some new, a new way to fit more on one of their disks. So we had, we already had a good working relationship with them, but certainly, you know, now that they're owned by Microsoft, they would have, yeah, I would think more access.
Yeah. What's your opinion on the modding community and what they do with the games?
I think it's pretty cool. It's neat to see what people do. I know, I guess what, there were things that we wanted to do, and like in so many different games, there's things that we want to do and you can't, you don't have time for it. You don't have the resources for it. And to, you know, see people at least touch on some of that is cool. Mm. They have a lot of the same instincts with want, you know, whatever it is, wanting X, Y, or Z to be different. Right. So it's pretty interesting. I mean, the thing too is they're unencumbered from, you know, breaking
politics.
The game. Well, and even just like breaking the game, right? Like they don't, they can do whatever they want, and like it's doesn't matter if some quest won't finish. Like they did it to themselves, right? So it's neat to see. I think it's obviously they have one of the strongest modding communities, and I think everyone would agree. Like that's why that those games are still alive today. I mean, you can still. I think Skyrim is still like $40 on Steam.
Yeah, and it sold like 50 million units or whatever it is.
I think it's over 60, and the game is like 15 years old.
Yeah.
And it's because, I think it's largely because people are modding it.
I sometimes wonder if the modding community is like a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, it's great because it extends the length of the game, but on the other hand, it can create the wrong perception that like Bethesda devs are lazy or something because they include something that wasn't in the base game. It's like, well, how can a modder do this? And then they weren't able to do it.
And again, though, like the modder can do said thing and it might not run on a PS3, right? Or it might like brick your save game or whatever. Like there's a lot attached to every piece of content you put in that, like, you know, it's got to be QA'd and yeah.
I think I remember Bruce saying to me that like adding stuff to the game was a problem for Bethesda devs because they just want to keep adding stuff.
we did.
Got to be a cutoff point.
No, we did, and I mean, like, and again, this kind of goes back to what I said: is we were empowered. Like, if you thought some of the coolest stuff in that game is probably something that one of the devs just made. They just made it some POI. They just made it and put it in there. And then, you know, eventually later it got on a schedule, but it wasn't, someone didn't dictate to them, like, make the thing, have to sell and like build a thing. I mean, a lot of the coolest stuff in that game is stuff that people did probably of their own accord. And in the other games as well. I mean, there's a lot of pieces of people, you know, when you look at that and when you see it from the inside that's in there.
Even on Starfield though, when it got to that size and scope?
Starfield, maybe not as much. Again, like I was, you know, I was,
you're a
we were all remote. Like I had much less.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had much less interaction with the team then because of the pandemic thing.
Yeah. All the developers that I've spoken to have all had various different reasons for leaving the company. With that being said, what is the main reason as to why you moved on to greener pastures?
I like to think I didn't really leave. Like I had transitioned to be a contractor, maybe related to the Microsoft purchase. You know, you're under the umbrella of this giant corporation, and like a lot of the rules become more right in terms of your relationship with the company. So I think like the first go around, you know, I had like an annual contract, and the first go around it was pretty easy. Second go around, it was like, you know, we're not, it got more and more difficult to make that thing work just at like an administrative level. I think in the end, I think the final incarnation of my work with them, I worked for my own company. My own company worked for a co-developer, and then that co-developer had a contract with Bethesda.
Jeez.
So, and this is all just like to satisfy the, you know, the Microsoft level bureaucracy, right? To be able to work in that paradigm. So it was difficult, and it didn't give me a lot of confidence that it would continue indefinitely. So in terms of like, I don't know, in terms of like leaving, I like to feel like I didn't. I just sort of, my contract ran out. But I did. I mean, I did tell them, hey, I'm not going to renew. I had a, I had a friend from Bethesda who had gotten, he secured some seed funding and was launching his own studio. And so I thought that was a good, it was kind of in parallel with my contract running out. I thought, well, this is a good opportunity to help him and see if I can help him get his thing off the ground, you know, give it a go. And I think one of the nice things about that is I had, my first game job was working at a startup as well. And it was kind of neat to do the same thing with, you know, 20 years of game dev behind you and all that hindsight.
Coming full circle.
And, yeah, I kind of came full circle and that was also a really good experience. You know, we put 2.5 years into that and built an awesome team and super cool demo and just I think largely fell victim to the, you know, the economic climate in games right now. Like,
well, yeah, everything's becoming consolidated as well.
Yeah.
So all these companies are getting swallowed up by the big publishers.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that you look at how much these games cost to make now too, like with the Concord thing to sink $250 million into something and then like just shut it down. It's crazy. And then you think like, again, GTA 6, yeah, they'll make their money, obviously, but it's going to, I mean, to think they've probably spent $1 to $2, maybe more billions of dollars on a game. It's a really big gamble. I think it's a good one for them, but having games cost that much to make. And even with like the Call of Duty numbers have kind of come out recently too. Like if you're spending $800 million on a game, like that's a really big spin at the table. Like that's scary. So it would make you not take chances on new stuff.
Well, yeah, because the industry kind of goes like this, right? So you've kind of got these curves where you make a whole bunch of money from the game and then you're working on the next game. So it drops off because there's all the sunk costs over the years. And then you hope that you reap that reward when the next game comes out.
It's high stakes. It's definitely high stakes. And, you know, that's where like some of these, and it sucks too. Like, you know, I was surprised if there wasn't a Microsoft layoff. You know, I think they had their earnings call. Was it last week? It was either this week or last week.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, oh, we're expecting a layoff. Like there's an earnings call coming. We have to make our numbers look better. Right. And it often seems to coincide with those types of events. And it sucks to see, you know, so many great devs getting laid off. And the crazy thing to me, we talked about this a little bit, is it's sort of like a COVID hangover, right? All this money poured into games during that time. And then now they're sort of experiencing the hangover from, but it's also contagious, right? Like the big publishers, you know, they're not investing like they were either. So, you know, we at my current thing, we pitched everybody. I mean, everybody there is to pitch to and they're just not investing right now. It's not happening.
Yeah, and it probably doesn't help when some of the highest salaries are in the US, and that's where most of the companies are as well. So naturally, higher salaries, because it's all time, right?
Sure, and even in the EU though too. Like I see a lot of the UK studios, like Ubisoft, just shut down two of them.
They have a ridiculous amount of employees though. It's like 20,000.
But in terms of salary. At least from, you know, I guess on the hiring end of it, right? So I staffed our art department, like people in the EU make a lot less in the games industry than the people in the US.
Yeah, definitely.
And they too are suffering. Like they're also like having to call people. But I am seeing more, I feel like I'm seeing more hiring in the EU than I am in the US. Maybe it's just my LinkedIn contacts makeup. I'm not sure how.
Maybe it's the algorithm.
How the algorithm works. I'm connected to all these, you know, a lot of the Eastern European, you know, Polish and Ukrainian like outsource studios and stuff. And so that probably does bend my algorithm a little bit. But you look at like the people, like I know they had Microsoft had that round of layoffs. I think it was last year, 1,000 people, wherever it was. And I was looking at these people. It was mostly art people I was looking at, but looking at like their art stations, and they're like, they're all so fucking good. I'm like, these people are so good.
Yeah.
How can they, like, how can they be laid? And they have pedigree too, and they're laid off. And you'd think that somebody would have a home for them, but.
Yeah. Yeah. I do wonder how Larian Studios with Baldur's Gate 3 fits into everything, because obviously they're based in Belgium. I don't really know much about the industry in Belgium, but I'm wondering if, because Baldur's Gate 3 was immaculately polished, right?
Right.
It probably pissed off some devs because they're like, hey, you're raising the bar too high here.
The game is awesome. I don't even know how many I have to look. I have at least a couple hundred hours into that game. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I wonder if it's maybe the studio culture or the fact that it's based there. I don't know. In terms of,
I don't know how big they are. Certainly they do have a bigger team, just at the level of polish that game has. I don't know actually what it is, but I think they're probably comfortable in their own skin. They're probably comfortable with the size they are. They're probably not trying to grow really fast. You know, plan it out.
I think that's probably the best way. If you can do it gradually, as opposed to just shooting up in numbers, then, as we spoke about before, right, you can kind of keep the culture the same, and there's kind of a smooth transition.
I mean, it happens all over too. Like I had another friend who worked at Bungie and had like the same, you know, the same thing, where it was like one day I was in the elevator. He said, one day I was in the elevator and I looked around, I didn't know a single person that was in there with me. It was just, you know, this is many years ago, but if they have this, you have that kind of growth when a game does well, and then inevitably there's like a crash.
I have some questions from the community.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have 80 to 120 milligrams of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Yeah.
Maybe you can answer them. Maybe you cannot. Maybe you'll be like, nah, man, I'm not answering these. But we'll see how we go. Okay. So this one's from T-Rex Riximus 359. Why was the slow-mo cinematic finishes and stealth kill animations removed from Starfield, previously in both Skyrim and Fallout?
The kill cameras. I don't know why. I think it, I don't know. I'm speaking as someone who honestly has no idea why. I think it was a new IP, and it just didn't get the same treatment. You know, that was a big like Fallout thing, right? The kill cam, as well as like that. As well as just bats in general. I don't know why. I would be guessing. I have no clue.
Yeah, that's fine. Okay. Yeah. Next one from PMC for Life. How does an animator go about animating a mythical creature? We have an idea of how a dragon or a ghoul should act, but what does the process of animating a pteromorph look like?
Well, there was a pteromorph in Starfield. Yeah. That was like the big thing. You know, I guess you just use your own creativity, right? Like I think all the rules of like physics and physically based, right? Things in the world that have weight and gravity. I think, yeah, it's kind of up to you to make it your own, something like that.
Yeah. Is it in some way more freeing? Because it's a creature. Like with a human, it has to look a certain way, because otherwise it kind of moves into the uncanny valley. But with a creature, I would think you have a bit more freedom in terms of how you animate it.
What the physics absolutely, should be. Yeah. Because with the human stuff, the uncanny valley happens very, very rapidly. But with, I would say that would probably be a really fun thing to animate. Yeah, that was Neil. Yeah,
so got to animate that. Just out of interest, out of everything that you've done across your entire tenure at Bethesda, what was the thing that you enjoyed animating the most?
Oh, man. Maybe it's animating, but I would say the thing that probably was the most fun to me, we did game jams at Bethesda.
Oh,
like kind of once a project, maybe we did it, maybe twice a project. I want to say once a project. There's some really cool stuff that people had done for that. And we would do it for a week. So it was like the only rules were that everybody did it and the thing that you did had to go in the game. And so you could like go absolutely bonkers with whatever you wanted to do. And we, when I say we, Dennis was involved in that too. We always tried to get vehicles into our games. So we were like, in Fallout 4, we had a, this is all hacky, right? Because it's game jam. It's not, you're not gonna ship with it. And that's why a lot of this stuff never sees the light of day. But we actually put a motorcycle into Fallout 4.
Really?
And that speaks to like the level of empowerment the tools kind of give you. Like people complain about the creation engine, and there are things about it that, you know, make me want to cry. But but as a dev, I can end to end, you know, at that time I could dream up whatever I wanted and I could get it in the game. Right. So we were able to like, I think we made it a weapon. I think it was a weapon in like its animation set. It animated the bones for the gun, like the wheels turned and everything, and handlebars worked. And because it was a weapon, like you could still shoot it. So you could ride this like Mad Max motorcycle around or have machine guns on it. And even the AI could do it because they just thought they were like holding a gun, even though it looked like they were riding a motorcycle, right? So those projects were always my favorite. There's a lot of stuff like that. But those were my favorite because we did stuff, you know, in many cases we knew would never go in the game, but you could really like kind of go nuts and, you know, flex your creative muscles to get it in there. I think we even had a sidecar. I think it even had a sidecar for Dog Meat to ride in at one point.
Really?
Yeah,
that's fascinating cool stuff. So how often would you do those fun sessions?
The game jam, I think they were once a project. There might have been a time where we maybe did two over a project, but I think it was once a project we would do it.
Is that close to the end of the project?
Yeah, and a lot of that stuff would sort of inform. It has to be at the end, right? Because the game has to like work.
Yeah, yeah, makes sense.
They have like a functional world to put all your stuff in. But a lot of that stuff too can inform maybe what we want to do for DLC. You know, I'm happy now they finally do. Like we did vehicles in Starfield too. We had a whole nother suite of vehicles again, like hacked in there. But now they actually have real vehicles. They've actually put it in, which is pretty cool to see that, to actually give a proper treatment, you know, to have that little buggy in there. And I think more stuff will come too, I would imagine. I think there actually might be two now, two different vehicles you can ride in there. But yeah, the game jam stuff was awesome. And then it also informed DLC. So trying to think, for Skyrim, we did, we did a Vampire Lord, which turned into the Vampire DLC for Skyrim.
That's
contributed to it. I mean, there's a whole quest line and everything, but you know, we were just trying to make. I think at the time we had watched like Underworld or something, that Kate Beckinsale movie.
Yeah, that's what Dennis said. Yeah.
Yeah, and we're like, oh, that's cool. Let's make something like that. And we just made it, and then it was like, hey, this fits into the idea that we already had for, you know, sort of a vampire type expansion. So put it in there.
Did that help? Happen often where you'd like watch a film and be like, oh, gotta make something like this in the game.
Well, you know, those game jams, they would sort of drop on you, like all of it is like, hey everyone, like whatever, next week, next month, we're gonna game jam. So you think up an idea, right?
Yeah.
And just thinking up what you wanted to do is the hardest part. Like trying to think up something cool and then how can we do it with like two people or three people, however many people you had working. A lot of the stuff was like a single person. But a lot of really cool stuff. I mean, there were some pretty mind-blowing game jam stuff.
When I spoke to Nate Perkypile, he mentioned that he thinks that Bethesda should migrate to Unreal Engine 5.
It'd be tough.
Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it's a bad idea?
Like, there's the argument for like cutting your technical debt, right? And like, Unreal is amazing. I've been using UE5 since it came out, so I've got two and a half-ish years. It's amazing. Like it, every like major problem you have as a developer like seems to be addressed in some way, like, oh, too many polygons, no problem, nanite, too many lights, no problem, megalite. Like they keep adding this stuff, and they have so many people working on that tech. I don't know how many people work on just the engine. I have no, it could be 1,000 people, I don't know, but it's the tools are so well designed and functional. Granted, like a lot of them are, you know, they release them when they're experimental, and it's kind of on you if you want to try and use it or not, but it does so much so well. That said, it doesn't do everything. And, you know, particularly like on the gameplay side of things, you'd have to re-architect all of that, you know, everything. We at my last studio at Something Wicked, we actually they didn't have any kind of like a quest, like narration tool. Like you couldn't set up like a dialogue scene, and we found like a deprecated something on it was already in the Unreal Engine, and we were able to sort of pick it up and fix it up. But they would have to like re-architect everything. It would be tough. Yeah, at some point though, I would argue, yeah, you probably should cut your technical debt and move on. But
well, I would say there would be two arguments as to why you keep the creation engine. One is you don't have to pay a licensing fee to Epic, for one.
Not that much, yeah.
And the second would be modding, because the creation engine is very good for modding.
Yeah, but with Unreal, like, right, any Unreal's free. Any kid can download Unreal and make a mod for.
But I think the modding tools for Creation Engine are more robust. Not that I know much about this. I don't mod games. This is just what I've heard. Yeah.
This is, I don't know either. I'm not a modder, but this is from what I've heard. I've tried. Like I'll tell you, the people that want to make mods for those games, they really want to make the mods for those games.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is from someone who knows the internal tools. Like it's certainly they're powerful, but it's not straightforward. Like you really have to like it's kind of its own sort of arcane skill what those guys do.
Yeah. Well, there was that mod recently of Fallout London. Did you see somebody did basically a Fallout 4 version of London?
Yeah.
So I don't know how many they must have spent years.
I will say too, like there's always like people hating on the creation engine, and again, like the bones of it are the technical debt, but so much of that engine is like new, is like the render is rewritten, the particle system's rewritten, the AI is rewritten, like every project that seems like, you know, they add new stuff to it. There's new tooling constantly being added to it. It's like really like the file formats and just like the data structures, you know, are what that is. But how that engine connects all the things that it does is kind of unique, I think.
Well, it's probably important that people understand that. It seems like Bethesda gets a lot of criticism sometimes, and I wonder if a lot of it is just propaganda.
If it were easy to switch, I would argue, again, this is me, I'm in no way affiliated with Bethesda anymore. If it was easy to switch, they would do it. They would switch. Right. I think the biggest argument to switch is the amount of like manpower that's going into the Unreal Engine that Bethesda would never, like you would never be able to dedicate if they have a whole company just of engine builders that were like core tech that got ahead of your game, like an entire game to be able to build a tool so you can make the next game with it. Right.
Yeah.
So that's something that I don't think they would ever be able to do. I don't think they would ever make their own new engine. I wouldn't think. I don't know.
No.
I know.
Not these days.
What are they called now? They're called Halo Studio 343.
Yeah.
They just switched to Unreal 5. I know.
And so did CD Projekt Red. They've done the same. Yeah. So.
Yes. Time will tell. Do it. I mean, it is a pretty remarkable set of tools, and I'm always amazed with how much stuff they add every release. It's pretty bonkers. And the tech behind it is just like, there's nothing else like it. I mean, Unity certainly is a capable engine too, but there's really nothing like Unreal, I don't think.
Well, I think it's the manpower as well. They can invest so much time, resources, and money into the thing to make it as robust as it is.
Right. And it used to be like just like the rendering was good. And then like they just keep adding more and more stuff. I mean, you can put like an untextured box in there and it, like it looks with Lumen and just the untextured box looks beautiful, you know, sitting there on a gray surface. So.
Do you think that chasing the realistic graphics trend is wise getting because of how costly it's becoming, right? And maybe if you...
I've had the realism debate a few times with people. I would argue it's probably easier to make something realistic looking now than to find a good style. Right? Like I know that if using Unreal, at least, like I know that might sound counterintuitive, but like finding a really strong style that's your own and that isn't like aped from somebody else, it's not easy. And just saying, hey, I'm making like everything is PBR and like looks real, you know, it's in my opinion, is easier to do now than it ever has been. And again, going back to like the Unreal, like the rendering and stuff, I mean, it's crazy.
I mean, you can have stylized realism, though. It's kind of, which you can probably get away with certain things.
But you have to, you know, it's, again, it's it takes a lot of, it takes a lot more creative effort to, like, make a style.
Yeah.
Than to just, right? The trade-off was always, like, the hardware couldn't do what it needed to do to make something render realistically. Right, like you couldn't do it in real time, and now largely you can. So I think it's only gonna go up. We're all our own worst critics, right? So we all, you know, are doing the best we can with the time that we've got. And you know, like I said, I mentioned the Red Dead team. I don't wish. I can only imagine having a 500 person animation team, you know, on test six. I don't know what their makeup is now. I would guess it's probably bigger, but not hugely bigger than it has been in the past.
Well, I will say Red Dead 2, but came out on PS4 and it still looks better than most PS5 games, you know?
Like, it looks really good. Yeah. They're definitely masters of their craft. And again, masters of different things, right? Like Bethesda they're masters of the kind of game that they make. I mean, I know, especially if you look at it in the time period that it came out, you know, with Skyrim being a 15-year-old game and Fallout 4 would be almost 10 years old now too. So,
yeah. Yeah, well, the Elder Scrolls 6, they can't just release Skyrim 2.0 because the landscape's fundamentally changed.
I would say that's the one thing I don't know anything about. I haven't been involved in test six at all. It's probably
a good thing.
I don't know. It's completely opaque to me. I mean, you can't be afraid of a challenge, right?
That's good.
I guess at the end of the day, like for me, it's the, you know, the gameplay is the most important thing to me, which might sound odd for an artist to say that, but, you know, first and foremost, I want to play a game that I enjoy the systems and have fun and then make it look good on top of that is the trick.
Yeah, well, with Blue Rooms and all that, it's the design and I suppose the programming aspects and then the art and the animation basically just enhance it and take it that much further to really sell the gameplay
idea. Yeah, I mean you could have a game that was like spot on 100% realistic and just suck. And I would have no desire to play if the gameplay wasn't. I have no interest in it at all.
Yeah. Cool, man. Well, hey, I'm going to wrap up there. Thank you so much for doing this.
Nice to talk with you.
Yeah, it's been great to chat. I feel honored to be the first person to do one of these with you. So.
I don't know why you shouldn't. Yeah.
Oh, but it's still great nonetheless.
I'll say it again. Like everybody. Everybody at Bethesda, they're all terrific people.
Yeah.
Great experience.
Everything I've heard about Bethesda internally, it sounds like the culture is great. The bureaucracy.
Yeah, and I know we touched on this too, but like when you look at a studio where, you know, again, between Skyrim and Fallout 4, maybe we lost like 5 or 6 people. Like,
that's
there are people that have worked there for 25, probably at this rate, 30 years that have been at the same place. It's a pretty remarkable thing.
Yeah, that's unheard of in the video game industry. Well, in the Western, Western part of the industry anyway.
I have friends who I don't even think have shipped a game like in the past decade because they've just repeatedly projects canceled, you know, change to this, change to that, studio closed, laid off, like so the one thing that Bethesda always was really good at was like shipping their games on time. I know Starfield did slip, but again, like that pandemic was kind of an unprecedented thing. So
well, I think the horrible aspect about not being able to ship a game is you can't even show your work off to a potential employer.
That's the problem a lot of people have, as they work on something and then can't even show it, which is sort of shitty. I mean, I get it, but you know, the other thing I guess I know we talked earlier too, when you see like these companies that move people like cross country and then like lay them off 4 months later, 6 months later, like that, you should have enough forethought on your business plan to not do that.
Terrible. I think that's a very dick move to do.
That's
for
a terrible
sure.
thing. People, you know, taking their families
and not
a good time, but hopefully the dust is settling now and things can get back to normal, I'm hoping.
Yeah. Hopefully Switch 2 and GTA 6 will cause interest and more investors will come back and people won't be so
are you gonna play GTA 6 on
PS5.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not waiting to it's not gonna come out on PC for like 2 years.
I know.
Yeah.
I've kind of gone full PC for most of my I gave up on console wars and been busy with Steam lately.
Oh, console wars are stupid. I think that's going away. Xbox.
Yeah, you think Microsoft is just going to exit console wars, Nick? Just be like a publisher?
I think so. I don't understand fully what their strategy is because they're increasing their revenue from a multi-platform perspective. I understand it, but you need to create FOMO in order for people to buy into your exclusive, you know, console, and you can't do that, especially when PlayStation and Nintendo have got their own exclusives. So I don't know, maybe they have some strategy that I'm not aware of, and you know, they must be looking at data, they must be looking at the economics of things. But I mean, with the cost of game development as much as it is now, maybe every game has to be third party. I mean, even Sony are doing they're releasing their games on PC now.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, it's like a year or a year and a half.
Yeah, I mean, that's also interesting too. Like, maybe it will get to a point where you just, you know, sell it to anyone who will buy it on whatever platform they'll buy it. Depends on what your business model is.
I think for a publisher, it makes sense to release it on as many platforms as possible. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about a company like Microsoft that own or they make their own hardware, I don't know how the argument really works. I mean, if they go the way of Sega, that's fine. I mean, Sega are doing well now, so who knows? It's very hard to understand the strategy and how you interweave Game Pass into it as well, because that's a whole
the Game Pass thing is odd. Yeah, it's odd. And how do you measure? Like, I don't know what their metrics are to measure, you know, what a successful game is, and you can't do it just by units sold anymore because you don't know how many people are buying Game Pass. Like Starfield launched on Game Pass, and it sort of obfuscates the success of it. It's hard to know.
Well, yeah, and then you have to take into account, I suppose, the percentage of the game that's then being completed. Like if I had Game Pass, I would be probably less likely to complete a game because I'm paying this fee per month, right? Like when you buy a game, like you pay full price or whatever, even if you don't like the game, you'll be more likely to finish it just because you paid like all this money for it, right? But with Game Pass, if you don't like it, you're like, oh, you just drop it and move on to the next one.
Right. He won't press through. Like, it'll just be like, yeah, something new.
Yeah.
There's also a huge, I've got a huge backlog of games. Like, there's so many games coming out, and it's hard to even keep up with them. It's a
Yeah,
lot.
totally. I have to keep a cap per year on how many games I play and be like, nope, I'll move it to the
What game
backlog.
do you think you played the most of in 2024? Is there one that
2024. I'm trying to remember what released last year. Geez, what came out last year? I actually, to be honest, I only got around to playing Resident Evil 4 Remake last year, and I must have played through it like 5 times. So that's probably the game off the top of
pretty
my
good.
head. I'd have to rethink. But this year is just terrible because there's just so many games coming out, and I'm like, oh God. And a lot of them are big open world games too. Like, you got GTA 6, you've got Avowed, you've got Assassin's Creed, you've got Monster Hunter, like, and there's a whole bunch I'm missing.
That's what everyone's making. They're all making open world games now, so.
So that's the way it goes. Cool, dude.
All right.
This has been fun, man. If anyone wants to stay up to date with anything that you're doing, where's the best place for them to follow you? Or can they follow you? Or you're
To
like, no
follow me,
no.
I don't really have social media. I've got LinkedIn.
Yeah, that's
That's
probably
his,
a good thing. Yep, stay off
which is funny because LinkedIn is almost turning into Facebook.
Totally, I agree.
And even like ads, I've got, I pay for a premium and I get so many ads and bots and the same kinds of things are happening, with that. So
Yeah,
yeah.
it feels like LinkedIn is turning into Facebook 2.0
Yeah.
for
I'm
sure.
resisting it.
Yeah,
So.
cool,
All
man.
right. Be well.
All right, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have 80 to 120 milligrams, whew, of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
There's nothing more satisfying than finding the perfect green paint for your living room. Except maybe popping open that can of Valspar Ultra and rolling that first smooth stroke on the wall. And there's nothing more satisfying than admiring your freshly painted wall.
Ooh.
Except maybe peeling off the painter's tape to see those crisp edges. But the most satisfying part of all? Valspar Ultra's price tag, starting at $29.98 a gallon. Affordable, durable, available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.